Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Director at AdvisorAnalyst.com, and this is Insight is Capital. Hugh Henry is here.
This is the Insight is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Hugh, welcome back. I'm so honored and excited to have you back, your third appearance here. This is such a pivotal moment in financial history. I can't wait to get your take.
Well, heavens, I mean, we're recording this on the Friday with the non-farm payrolls, and I don't have many tweets I've received saying, man, your timing is off, my friend. You know, this economy booming. You know, so.
Well, that's a, yeah.
Everything is a question of, you know, the lens that you deploy. Maybe my lens is a faulty, but, you know, I can hear the scream of the butterflies, and the butterflies are telling me portents of profound danger, the danger of a synchronized global recession. The butterflies are telling me that it's here, it's now. Data gets revised in the future. I mean, calculating right. The GDP of America or the world is a, you know, is an existential exercise, and is constantly subject to revision. If you look back at the data central banks were apparently using back in as we went into the storm of 2008, you know, they thought the economy was expanding, and 9-12 months later, the official data was revised to say, sorry guys, it was down. I don't spend my time looking at real-time data. I'm kind of like, you know, a kind of preposterous George Lucas kind of, I feel the force. I believe that if you can understand and tap into the prevailing zeitgeist, the narrative, then it kind of just, it's a flow thing, and it will tell you where this thing is heading. So, time captures, or the data catches up with reality eventually.
So I know it's a bit of a yawn. We got this ceiling debt deal. I'm not so concerned. As I said, I think it's a bit of a yawn as well. I think you'll agree with that. But what does that do? Like, do you see that as having any relevance in terms of liquidity going forward, like in the second half of this year or into next year? There's a lot of chatter about it, obviously, and maybe it isn't the most exciting topic, but I thought we'd get it out of the way right away since it's just happening right now. Mm. What are your thoughts on it? I mean, do you have any thoughts on it? And
yeah. For sure. Yeah. I mean, I'd pick an argument with a lamppost, you know. the story of the supply is like, I keep quoting Jim Morrison. I got some friends inside. I got some friends, and they work on Wall Street. And, you know, they phone their buddies. They're like, oh my God, like, you know, like, we're really worried. Like, you know, the Treasury's going to have to issue a lot of paper. And I'm here, I'm giving you the edge. Like, what we're seeing here, we're at the core. And we just think, you know, the price is going to have to go down to take on the supply. Yeah. So what can you give me an order? Yes, it's, you know, order madness, I believe. Let me be less facetious. This is the fear of supply is a recurs over time in history. There's the old French economist Say's law that supply creates its own demand, and that seems relevant in this context, in that there are already signs of investor risk aversion and a preference for, yeah, you know, preposterous term, but the one that that the lexicon reaches out for, riskless securities.
Right.
And we're seeing that phenomenon play out in the S&P. You know, the market is being pushed higher and higher on the strength of no more than 7 mega cap stocks. And, you know, and within maybe one or two, well, within all of them, of course, is this fascination of AI, and are we on the verge of another kind of WWW type thing. But I think if you scrape further, these are businesses which are perceived as being riskless with regard to the vagaries of the economic cycle.
Right.
Stan, the legend, Druckenmiller was actually reflecting on this, that throughout every great bear market, there was a collection of stocks which were deemed to be independent of that, and which was, despite the carnage elsewhere, or maybe it was oil stocks in the 1970s, consumer staples, or and the like. And if you check his filings, I mean, he owns NVIDIA. I mean, I'm sure he's taken profits, given great call. AMD, and then he owns, you know, the other five big ones. Doesn't own Apple, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But my perception is that's people they have the equity mandates, they're committed to owning equities, and therefore within their equity allocation, they're being more discerning, and they're pushing to the kind of riskless or less economically sensitive component of the spectrum. With regard to the treasury, so I've espoused since the start of the year a kind of trading recommendation for long duration to have ownership of, let's say, the TLT. It's a retail ETF, will get you 17 year plus maturities. And there, despite the profound fear, and again, here we are with the non-farm payrolls, we came through January where everything was revised higher. You know, you travel on a plane, it's busy, the hotel is busy, you know. UK inflation just seems to go higher and higher.
Well, that's the thing, right? That's the thing. Inflation is stickier than people thought. And therefore, you know, there's also the impulse that the Fed might hike one more time, right?
Indeed. I don't think inflation is proving stickier. I think the government measured inflation, and I don't like to harbor on too much with this, but I think government prices, they've got flaws. The core is being held up by the preponderance of the rental or the housing component for inflation.
Right.
It's very predictable. It's
just the owner equivalent rents.
Yeah. The owner equivalent and the way they calculate it, it just lags. It will be elevated for, I think, the next 4 or 5 months. If you look at real time, it's descending. So I can sit here today and I'm pretty confident that 12th of June, when we get the CPI, okay, we're going to print 3.7. There's not a great mystery with these things. It'll be out and there'll be an over and under, but it'll be like basis points. It'll be 3.7, Fed's 5.25, real rates are positive. Anyway, to the riskless, but, you know, despite, you know, there's a more than palpable sense of fear and anxiety with regard to pricing and the implications for long-dated treasuries. But, you know, for the last 7-8 months, the price hasn't made a new low. And that's kind of interesting. And then I would say that you've had mean reversion. You know, you've taken out, you know, treasuries are a component of price plus the carry. They can't take the carry away from you, but the price component, we've wiped out 15 years. I call that mean reversion. We're like over 2 standard deviations away from the norm. Again, if we had a bell curve when we looked at it, we're saying that where we are today, there's very few incidences of trading at these levels. It's unusual. That's all it is. It's unusual. Yeah. And so it reminds me of the S&P in March 2009. Prices looked as if they were going to reset to zero, but you'd had 6 months of wild oscillations, but no new low. And prices, of course, had fallen the best part of 60%. And so the S&P had mean reverted. It was the last great mean reversion. And I have to say, mea culpa, I missed it. I was full of loathing and prejudice because of just how terrible the journey had been, having had a glimpse of the future, seeing the way that the authorities and other market participants did everything to postpone or try and ban, if you will, truth discovery. And that was an error with me. So the sum of all my knowledge is that treasuries for me for me feel like the S&P 2009. Time will reveal. But to your point about supply, the circumstances which create a demand for people owning Microsoft and Amazon and Google et al. Are really the same circumstances that I think we'll see people wishing to increase their allocation to treasuries, which is just weakness prevailing. Prevailing economic
weakness. This is the duration argument, right?
I mean, duration, but no, it's an asset allocation preference, which will be, you know, I think the economy is going to weaken further here. This is as good as it gets.
Yeah.
Like you said, the Fed's a no push. I put out a thing today, like saying, heavens, this is kind of very Aesopian fables that, you know, the market sits piggybacking on the economy. So the scorpion and the frog, and the frog's halfway across the stream, and the market's like, you know, jiggy. NASDAQ's like kind of lifting off into kind of a bubble like kind of fighting dynamic. And the frog's like, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
You know, this poison is, I'm not going to make it. I need them cutting rates, and I need them cutting rates now. And the more you oscillate at this high level, the more they're going to delay. And for me, it's a coiled spring, the greater the ultimate correction. So that's going on, if you will. And that would be my counter.
I mean, if you look at, you know, the S&P, you've got these seven to 10 names driving the entire index, and you've got 50-60% of the index underwater. And, you know, is that, does it feel like, maybe not on the bond side, but definitely on the high duration, long duration stock side, where, you know, we've got these big, you know, gigantic tech name, mega cap tech names driving the market, driving the entire return of the S&P and the NASDAQ, doesn't it seem like the market got ahead of itself on the expectation that rates will drop? I mean, for the same reason that you would take the long duration bond bet on the same, you know, on the basis of not only are you getting yield, but you're also going to get the duration, the gains from a duration play over the next number of years where rates recede or revert back to the mean. I can't say it's premature on the bond side, although there already was quite a retracement from the higher yields of on the long dated treasuries to, you know, where they are today. But, you know, the stocks have a lot more. You know, is it just a recovery play? Is it just because they got hit hard last year and people, you know, like, I think this is one of those hated rallies, is it not? Where you know, the risk averse exited the market last year, and then now they missed the boat on the turnaround in January in tech stocks.
So it's many things. I don't think the tech stocks are being pushed or bid higher on the basis of an expectation of lower interest rates. I think those stocks are being bid higher again via, let's call it a faith-based, well, I don't even want to call it faith-based. So what I want to draw the comparison with what's happening there with what we've seen in Bitcoin and in the run-up to 70,000 and periodically when gold has, you know, has a run. How do you value Bitcoin or gold?
Good question.
There's no valuation. Yeah. So it's a belief system. It's not to put it down. It is art. Yeah. I mean, the price of the Modigliani or the Picasso is determined, you know, by the marginal buyer. And so those 7 to 10 stocks, you know, which account for more than the rise in the S&P between them.
Right.
NVIDIA trading on 25 times revenue, there's no valuation metric. There's just a belief just now that given some, I think, deep-seated fears of where we might be heading, that you might, if you're going to lose money, you're likely to lose money less rapidly, maybe, in those names, because it's not a GM that gets slammed, you know, when the economy hits the brakes. And in the meantime, as you wait, you know, these things have got momentum. You know, I was reallocating out of my commodity equities and just saying, you know, like, yeah, I own them on the basis that when the Fed inevitably cuts, right, you will go back to the kind of, oh, it's 2009-11, it's hyperinflation, and they'll catch a bid. And of course, the Fed will be seeking to kind of take us from positive real rates to flat or negative rates. And that's an environment which is benevolent to those asset classes. So I don't think it's interest rates. I think it reveals the psychosis of the market. It looks as if it's really kind of risk-seeking, but it's actually the opposite. And that, I think, if that is flamed by evidence of a further slowdown in the global economy, of which there are many signs, then that's how you catch a bid, right, on the treasuries. The other thing with the treasuries is, which makes them very appealing, is what's going on in the euro dollar system. So this is the offshore, this is offshore to the United States, and where the preponderance of dollar bill creation occurs. And it's best thought of as a pawn shop, you know, and hedge funds and other banks will go into this matrix, and the pawn shop dealer, the repo man, says, what you got? Mm-hmm. You know, and in good times, you say, I don't know, I've got $1 billion of S&P equities, and I'm looking for a line of credit. I need, will you give me $1 billion? And he's like, yeah, sure, no problem, you know. Another manifestation of that would be, I go in and I've got $1 billion of Italian 10-year government bonds, the BTP. And the guy's like, wow, this is risk-free. This is, you know, this is, this, Mr. Draghi, the, you know, the ECB president, it's 2014, he did alchemy. This is really a boon. This is the safest asset in the world. I'll give $1.5 billion in return. Can I keep this? But the deal is, you got 24 hours. You better haul your ass back into the pawn shop the next day, because the guy has the right to change his mind every 24 hours. That's how the system, right, works. And what's been happening, it sounds absurd because there was some strong, you know, current data today, but yeah. Look at the oil price, look at the copper price, look at the data out of China, you know, look at Europe, European loans annualized the last 6 months. Credit is now contracting within the banking community. You know, we've lost four banks. You know, we had a Credit Suisse, which passed with flying colors, all of its solvency, you know, was interest rate hedged.
Yeah.
You know, didn't have the issue with the hold to maturity. It's gone, you know. And so when you're going back to the pawn shop every day, the guy's like, you know, I've been thinking just a little bit. And I'm thinking, you know, that S&P equity basket.
Yeah.
You got anything better? And this conversation is going to continue. And they're like, well, this is how we go. I'm going to close you out unless you can come back before midday with $1 billion of US Treasury bills. And so what do you do? And this is what happened in 2008. Yeah. Every crisis, every economic contraction begins with a crisis and the confidence of collateral, the collateral which is presented to the repo man, to the pawn shop guy. That, my friend, okay, that is my negation to this presumption that treasury supply is going to hit prices, okay? And it feels fantastically logical when prices have corrected by 50%, you know, the S&P didn't feel like a buy in March 2009, but that's why we have other forces. I can feel the force, you know, listen, Luke, switch off the computers.
My guess is just that, you know, I mean, it was a political football, right? I mean, once again, it's always a political football, but it's that it's more, you know, the signing of the bill. The signing of the debt ceiling deal is the more important thing. And it's like, you know, well, if we don't get what we want, we're not going to sign your paper. And, you know, that's that brinksmanship that, you know, one party's playing against the other. So.
It's ignorance. Yeah. It's ignorance. Again, you know, my message is, understand the narrative, understand the zeitgeist. Like, very, very few people do.
But it's like mutually assured destruction, isn't it? I mean, if they don't.
Yeah, but we're still missing the hidden. We're still missing the, you know, there is a death thought that is creating a gravity, which is the true actor behind the debt ceiling.
Okay.
The debt ceiling is recurring because debt to GDP continues to rise.
Right,
okay.
Right.
To GDP, let me tell you, will be higher in 5 years' time than it is today. I can say that with surety. Okay. Because for the last 25 years, the global economy has operated under a system which is unusual, which is unproductive, and which creates a deficiency in demand. A deficiency in demand is disinflation. What is that change? That change is, and I say 25, specifically 25, but you can trace it for 40, 50 years. It has been the rapid super-industrialization of the Chinese economy, replicating the march of progress that the US enjoyed in the 19th century. The march of progress in the 19th century was funded by the US running trade deficits, every year trade deficits. And the rest of the world, with their surplus savings, came in and funded the abundance of NPV positive projects in infrastructure and elsewhere in the United States. China, by contrast, has been operating a closed capital account. And that means it's been running persistent trade surpluses, and trade surpluses of a magnitude that we have never experienced in the universe of mankind. Yeah. In 2008, the trade surplus in manufacturing for China was almost 20% of GDP.
Right.
Okay. To give you a reference point for that, when the US was at its peak vis-a-vis the size and the scale of its economy vis-a-vis the rest of the world, the US hit, and the rest of the world was in disarray. We had two global military campaigns which wiped out the capital stock of the competition. US surplus was 6%. China's recorded something 3x greater. So this is unheard of, right? But what it means is China supplies, oversupplies, it is oversupplied in manufacturing capacity. And the deficit countries accept that capacity via imports. Imports, when you calculate GDP, is a negative. It takes away from GDP. Okay, so it's deflationary or disinflation. It's a D word. Choose your point. Now, historically, consenting adults would enter that agreement on the basis of, you know what, I'm going to take it in the ass a little bit, excuse me for my crude language, but I'm doing so because I've got foresight. You know, we've had difficulties in our relationship over the years. You've been dirt poor, and when you're dirt poor, your ideology gets a little bit kind of like, you go totalitarian, you go communist, into the redistribution of incomes, you know, and it leaves you in the toilet, okay? I'm thinking I might spend 20 years here, and it's going to be kind of hard, but at the end, my God, you guys are going to be like super prosperous, less prone to the kind of whack job kind of politics. We're going to trade, and the sum of that is going to enrich me as well as you. And the Chinese have reneged on that. They've reneged on that. Instead of buying American goods and services that they did from the rest of the world, they buy financial assets. Okay. So what they give you, in one hand, they give you wage price disinflation, and they give you asset price inflation. And so we're left in the world today. And again, you can be specific. Okay. GDP in America will grow under one circumstance and only one circumstance only. There's meant to be three variables. Population growth, productivity growth, and debt growth. Okay. We've only got one variable which is operating today owing to this international accord, if you will. And so we had a debt ceiling issue in 2011 or was it 2013? We're having one today. We will have one in 2 years' time, or whenever it's being pushed out, we'll have one again. Rather than butt heads, they should be saying, why is this? Why do we keep hating the stealing? But if you ask that question, it's like, look over your shoulder. Yeah. It's your Chinese buddies. And they're playing the game.
Yeah.
So if you want to resolve the debt stealing, the U.S. has to close or pour some grit into its capital account. It has to make it hard for sovereign nations to buy its financial assets. It has to replicate what the other guys do.
Yeah.
Do that and the debt ceiling disappears.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Walmart era, you know, of Americans and elsewhere wanting cheap goods, you know, that just went on for far too long, you know, where, you know, our stores and our, you know, our consumption is all based on goods made abroad. They're not buying our cars and our goods and our clothing. They're making them for us. So why don't they just make them for themselves? Right.
If they made them for themselves, then they would be absolutely drowning in overcapacity. Yeah. Yeah. They would go down harder than a brick into water.
But the thing is that they don't have to buy anything from us. Except for luxury goods. All right. Like luxury, you know, Mercedes, Benz, BMW, foreign made goods that have a name, that have a brand that they want to own. The generic stuff, they don't care because they're the ones already manufacturing it. So if they have.
There's a reason for that. But again, so you've got to strip away, you know, the skin of the banana, reveal the banana. So that is with specific bureaucratic intent, right? There are things that they do which leads to that conclusion. Okay. There's nothing wrong with the procurement by Amazon, sorry, by procurement
Walmart,
by Walmart
Amazon, yeah.
of cheap goods. Exactly. Alibaba. Nothing wrong with that.
yeah.
You know, and you're giving the other side a leg up. Okay. But what happens is that the central authority redistributes wealth within its economy from the household sector
right.
to the center. Okay. And it does buy, like I say, they buy financial assets, though they buy claims on the United States. Okay. In doing so,
isn't it an echo of what Japan did in the 80s? I mean, where the Japanese wealth got to such an extreme and property prices, maybe that's not the right parallel, but property prices in China aren't low. And, you know, maybe they're lower now because of the, you know, some debt reorganizations that have happened there. But I feel like, you know, where Japan ultimately, you know, went through its deflationary, you know, period, which has been forever. You know, we run the risk of doing that now. And, you know, in essence, I mean, you know, Chinese capital is coming. I mean, capital from China is coming and being invested, as you say, in our assets, in our financial assets, in our in property, in everything, wherever they can put their money. And so they get all the rewards and they don't have to, you know, it's a one-way street, isn't it? I mean, the benefit is all theirs.
Okay, we need distinctions and subtleties here. When you say the Chinese, okay, so there's a closed capital account, so Chinese folk can't right. take money out. Okay. They wish they could. You know, Chinese property hit a high watermark of $60 trillion U.S. dollars. My God, if they, you know, if you were sitting there and you could sell it, get the red cabbage, I call renminbi red cabbage, turn it into dollars, buy dollar assets. Oh my God, would you do it? Would you do it? Okay. But they do
manage to. A lot of capital does come out of China. It gets converted, it gets transferred out. I know it's very difficult under the circumstances that you're talking about, but how do they do it? How is it happening that so much capital from private
It's not private. Private is immaterial. Let me tell you how they do it, right? You're an Chinese exporter. You've sold $1 billion worth of goods to Walmart. They send you over the dollars, okay? When you go to buy, you know, dinner that night, they don't take dollars. They take red cabbage, okay? So the central bank sits in the middle, and your bank sells your gift, transfers your dollars to safe, you know, the repository at the central bank, and then they return the red cabbage and you go and buy your dinner, okay? And then SAFE, the organization that controls this in China, the sovereign buys U.S. treasuries and mortgage-backed paper, okay? And collectively, I think he bought between $7 and $9 trillion. And it's just the tip of the iceberg, because those treasury bills then get, they lend them to their banking sector. The banking sector then goes to the pawn shop and it goes, hey, you know, I got $1 billion treasuries. We'll give you $2 billion treasuries. If you give me $1 billion treasuries, we'll give you a line of credit. That's what happens. And then that's what ratchets up asset prices. So it's not Japanese citizens, the Japanese citizens, right? So the sovereign is doing that because it's selling its currency and it's buying the dollar, right? So that's the important thing. Chula, 30 years ago, China was 0.7 trillion GDP. Today it is almost $18 trillion, okay? Lots of remarkable transformations have occurred, okay? The currency has devalued, okay? The currency's gone from 6 to 7.2 over that period. That makes no sense. That's the hack. That's the cheat, okay? That's the cheat that America accepts. No one else accepts it. It's the US accepts it, the UK accepts it, Canada accepts it, New Zealand, Australia, kind of bits of Europe, but that's it. All right. Everyone else is closed for business. They're just like, hey, like, you know, all you're getting is asset price inflation and disinflation for the real folk. So debt ceilings require the understanding, right? The Chinese currency over that period should have appreciated. Now, any smart folk listening to this link, sure, but if they were open today, their currency would be slapped. Their currency would trade 10, if not 50, given the rush to get out of the damn things. Okay. But the reality is, if they had made this process, if they had been equitable, given the great riches open to them by the entry into the WTO, and they'd allowed their currency to freely flow, it'd be trading at 4.5, not 7.3. And those Chinese citizens would be buying Fords. I mean, would they be buying Fords? I don't know. You'd be buying goods and services from the rest of them.
Yeah.
They can't. They're held in penury. When Stalin, the 14th Congress of the Bolshevik Party, when they went for their super industrialization in 1926, it's the same thing. They couldn't, the rest of the world would not invest in the investment projects domestically in communist Russia. Okay. And so instead, they did a barter system with the Nazis, and they traded their breadbasket, the great wheat fields of Russia, and at the time Ukraine, and in return, the Germans gave them know-how and technology to industrialize, okay? But that was a transfer of wealth. It was a profoundly awful transfer of wealth, because effectively 30 million people lost their lives because they couldn't eat, okay? But so that's one way of industrialization. Thankfully, 30 million people are not dying in China, but they're impoverished relative to where the fruits of their labor deserve them to be. And that creates the deficiency of demand, which means entrepreneurs across the world, no one wants to invest because wages are too low. And so future demand is...
I think since Xi Jinping got into power... You know, it strikes me as very similar to the path that Putin took as well, which was that, you know, in a time when free market ideology was supposed to continue to, you know, make, you know, like the progress in China was supposed to continue down the free market path. Along comes Xi Jinping, and he's the new Mao. You know, he's the new incarnation, the new face of the Communist Party. You know, this princeling, right? He comes back and revives a reversal of free market reforms, and so in a way, like it's because of, you know, there's all these great things happening in China, but at the same time, as you say, there's this bifurcation, there's this dichotomy of you know, those in the interior and the, you know, the rural class versus the urban class, and you know, they're kind of being held hostage there in a way. A form of you know, just maintaining cheap labor, maintaining a very stratified society where you have the rich and then you have everybody else. I mean, the same things happen. I think there's a parallel. I'm not saying it's crystal clear, but if you look at you know, the Soviet Union, we've talked about this before, where you know, literally a handful. Maybe more than slightly more than a handful of oligarchs control all of the wealth in Russia, and everybody else works for them.
Well, you could say, I mean, that was the case at the end of the 19th century in America. You know, the early industrialization does lend itself to, you know, super concentration of wealth. To your point, you know, I'm no fan of Z, but you know, Z wasn't there. He wasn't there in 1994 when Canada, the US, and Mexico signed NAFTA, and the Chinese devalued their currency enormously. Okay, he's not responsible for the fact that the economy went from $1 trillion to $18 trillion, and yet its currency is weaker than it was 40 years ago. He's not responsible for that, but he is responsible for the awful thing where today, I think, investors are assigning. They're not always signing it, but I mean, for me and my, I want to say, thoughtful, curious buddies, the notion of a confrontation with China via Taiwan is now like 5% probability. That's a 1 in 20 probability. I never thought we'd be anywhere close to that. Yeah. And that's the Z, or that's the Putin.
It's a lot of influence. Posturing, though.
And all I they're mean, doing
it's a,
is...
It's a great deal of posturing, whether or not he acts on it. I mean, obviously the probability has gone up. But, you know, like, so it just feels like, it's, it feels like as China has gotten increasingly enormously wealthy as a country, that Xi has come along and he's just put up more and more walls, more and more barriers, right? To it's amazing. Yeah.
He's a Marxist. He's a Marxist. And Marxism is profoundly short on human ingenuity, right? And so Xi and his advisors, and I get it. I get where they're coming. They're like, you know, China peaked in 2008. Okay. All the spectacular linear GDP growth is fake growth. What is fake growth? Fake. You know, they start each year and they tell you what GDP will be in 12 months' time, right? It's just a function of spending variables. Okay. That's not a function of wealth creation. China has not created wealth in 15 years. Look at the stock market. It took the biggest, dumbest investors 15 years to work it out. They all went like hugely into China in 2021, and they're like, oh. But you know, the stock market does nothing. It's flat as a pancake. There's no wealth. So you get extraordinary linear GDP as a triangle, and you get stock market flat, right? The difference is wealth destruction, right? So, and they've blown their debt out. They've ended up making the same errors that Brazil made in the 70s, Japan made in the 1980s, that Russia made in the 1960s, 70s. They know it, and they're like, nerd. Okay, so what is a Marxist? A Marxist says, we've reached the permanent plateau of our prosperity. And so all of Z's princeling chat is just about redistribution. They've given up. Yeah, they're walking away from us.
The point you were trying to make was that instead of hurling around this debt ceiling issue like some political football, the, you know, our U.S. leaders are not, or lawmakers aren't looking at the real problem, which is that you have this growing debt. You have this problem with China, right? I mean, and maybe the problem is not China. Maybe the problem is the U.S. being far too open, right? And you know, putting in some new reforms in order to make it harder, like you said. They're not actually tackling the real problem, right? America's not putting up the correct defenses, economic defenses against.
Do you know why?
A symbiotic relationship that they just haven't realized is not balanced any longer.
There's a symbiotic relationship. Like there are two agents that have prospered in this environment. You know, the centralist Communist Party of China and Wall Street and everything with proximity to Wall Street. Yes. I mean, here I am, the Caribbean. I'm Mr. Wall Street. Like, who do you think rents my place? Rich folk, rich folk get their money from Wall Street, don't you? China effectively is a quantitative easing program. It creates money from trade. And it buys financial assets, and those financial assets get leveraged by the euro-dollar system, the pawn shop guy. And they've taken the equity market to like 2.2 times GDP, and they've taken private equity to the sky. They've made Wall Street rich, right? And rich people, this is the Wizard of Oz, right? William Bryan's Jennings.
Yeah, William Jennings Bryan.
I think how you pronounce Jennings Bryan, you always get it the wrong. William Jennings Bryan, an amazing orator. And back in the 1890s, when America was crying out for a bimetallic monetary policy where we would have silver and gold, gold had largely been consumed in terms of the credit boom following the Civil War. And there was kind of just, there wasn't enough gold to furnish the extra credit demand to take the economy higher. And William Jennings Bryan's like, you know, except silver, which was plentiful in America, and it's effectively a loosening of policy. He said, stop crucifying the common man like on a cross of gold. Wonderful speech, right? He is the lion, right? He's a ferocious populist, right? But he has no bite. He has no bark, right? Because of the witches of on the East Coast. The J.P. Morgans of the Jamies of this world, like, we got to talk about this. No. You know, they have to perpetuate that. Why would they be, if a U.S. politician closed or interfered with the U.S. American capital account, asset prices would collapse. Right? So there are no policy advisors advocating that. Okay. So that the 99%, like, you know, you don't count. That's why this situation is happening.
It's the agenda, right? The agenda is conflicted. So there's a real conflict. I mean, there's this massive conflict of interest because capital markets don't want to mess with the gravy machine, right? They don't want to mess with they don't want to mess with their money. They don't want to upset the apple cart, yeah.
And they control it.
So it's funny, you know, they Hugh, I was gonna ask you, and you know, all the questions I had lined up to ask you today, you answered them before I could start, before I could actually ask you, right? And my open-ended questions was, what have you got your sights on? Where are you putting your money right now? Or, you know, maybe we haven't gotten to the second question, but what are your sights on right now? And I think we've just spent the last, you know, while talking about what you've got your sights on, which explains why, you know, before we started, you mentioned that you wanted to have Michael Pettis at your conference, right? And that's to talk intimately about what's going on in China and what he sees at your conference.
Yeah, I mean, Michael is a modern day Keynes. Absolutely gets it. Keynes, the Bretton Woods Conference walked out. He's like, you guys are committing a grave error. You just cannot operate global trade with open capital accounts. You know, capital is mobile. Technology will facilitate it, and it will be profit seeking. And you will create a deficiency in demand. You know, please don't do this. He wasn't listened to. And you know, ultimately, you know, the economics is a process of seeking equilibrium, the search, and the validation of an equilibrium. The present system makes equilibrium. It's very hard to return.
Things are really unbalanced. They're out of balance with China, that's for sure. Yeah.
Well, I mean, globally, everything's out of balance. So we all know it's crazy. We don't know when it ends. You know, there's no incentive to say it ends. All that, you know, my argument just now is, you know, the economy will wither. It's not, given this trade environment, you can't then come in with debt almost four times the GDP and have 2% positive real rates, you know, 5.25 normal.
Oh, yeah, we've seen
that. Break things. Okay. So we're going to get it. We've seen that, right? But I'm not saying it's like, I'm just saying the S&P in that environment may lose 20, 30, 35%. Okay. I'd be a buyer. Like the bonds have lost 50%. I'm a buyer, right? Yeah. Bitcoin has lost 60% of its value. I'm a buyer. Okay. Don't show me individual stocks that have done that. Too much idiosyncratic risk. But you were asking about investment. I work and I try and encourage, you know, the folk who try and do this, you know, in their homes. Think of a quadratic expression, compass points, north, south, east, west. You've got four quadrants. Think of always having an exposure and then charge yourself the responsibility every 6 months or so to change the allocation between those asset classes. What are those asset classes? Stocks, call it the S&P, treasuries, and then below it we have alternatives, precious metals, Bitcoin, commercial property, residential commercial property, index linked, you know, TIPS, private equity. There's like $100 trillion in that. You know, it's a big bucket there. And then the other side is cash. You know, cash just now, like, you know, pay me 5%. You know, I'm going to sit out on the beach.
Right now, that's the favorite asset. So. No surprise there, right? I mean, it's riskless or risk-free for the time, you know. Yeah.
It has a very short tenor. That's the problem. It's a very short tenor. Right? So compounding is where you get rich, baby. You know,
it's just a temporary. But as you said, to move around those four quadrants, right now one of those four quadrants in favor is the cash quadrant. But it's not going to be forever. It's not going to be for the long term. You have to, you know, at some point in the next while, you'll have to start, you know, re-risking, right? Or I mean, you should be re-risking right now. I mean, to some degree, right?
Sure. Well, okay. So, I mean, so my risk portfolio is ton of cash if we're in that bottom quadrant. Okay. If we come up to equities, almost nothing. If we were talking a percentage of NAV, I'd have like maybe 15% in, you know, the go seven stocks. But really, I'd own NVIDIA and
AMD. Yeah.
AMD. I would apply micro to AMD. Yeah. You know, bubbles are amazing. Okay, but I'm not playing it with 150%. I'm playing with 15% of my. I can almost hope I lose. You know, it's kind of fun, and I might lose on this tiny quadrant. I've got cannons, I've got big guns pointing elsewhere in my other quadrants, but I've got almost nothing. Right, so maybe 15% in equities today. 15, not 50. 15. Okay, treasuries. I don't have in terms of. I have really nothing because there's no trend. I only buy things which are trending.
Right.
Yeah, you need the legitimacy of a trend to stop you going, becoming poor. Okay. But I do have call options. I'm willing to own, you know, an absolute determined loss. And I, given the prevailing circumstance, I can own calls on the TLT.
Right.
You know, at the money. For January 25, which is a million years away, okay, And that cost me, you know, if I wanted, that cost me nothing. Like, just, so again, if I'm sitting there and I've got $100 million, dream on. I put $15 million into equities. I'd maybe put $700,000 right. into call options on treasuries. I'm done. Okay. You come down Bitcoin. I'd probably have about two, you said $100 million portfolio. I'd have $20 million in Bitcoin today. And why, you know, I'm not going to tell you it's going to change the world. I'm just saying that I can imagine that it's now an accepted asset allocation as an alternative. And today it's the total sum value of it is $500 billion. Okay. And the segment that it lives in is $100 trillion. And I don't see anything in the segment kind of going shooting up dramatically. I see private equity coming down. I see commercial property coming down. Maybe gold goes up, okay.
Well, for sure, as long as the dollar's weakening, okay. Sure.
Gold, however, is
not even with that.
Well, not that. You don't even
have to say that. Just as a defensive asset.
You don't have to say that. Come on, like open eyes. You know, the dollar has gone up. The dollar has gone up the last 15 years versus all other currencies, and gold has gone up.
Well, okay, you know, so that's short term.
You don't need that validation of currency.
Yeah. No, not your 15 years
short term.
Since the dollar started weakening a little bit recently. Yeah.
Whatever. My point is, gold is $12 trillion, right? So all the gold bugs, right? Gold is $12 trillion. Okay. US equities are about 2x GDP. Okay. GDP is 23 trillion. So the stock market is about $50 trillion. Okay. So, and you get people say gold's going to go to 6,000. It's going to go up 3x. Well, if it goes up 3x, you're saying it's going to be $36 trillion. So it's going to be kind of like 80% of the market capitalization of all stocks today.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, you know, I drop a lot of acid. I'm an imaginative guy, maybe, but I don't think so. Risk adjusted, I don't think so. Okay. However, could it have a some monetary value of $2 trillion? Yeah. Would that change the needle anyway? Well, no, right? So I've got something that's lost 60%. I go in and I own it in a grotesque manner via the grayscale closed end. I say it's gruesome because they charge a 2% management fee for a passive fund, right? Yeah, and your typical ETF manager is charging 15 basis points. So they're charging, it's insane. However, it trades at a 40% discount, okay? So I've got an asset class. It's tiny in the context of all other assets. It's dropped 60%, okay? I can buy it in a very loathsome vehicle where I buy it at a 40% further discount, okay? And then I've got a bit of idiosyncratic opportunity. Maybe the U.S. administration is going to change in the next 2 years. Maybe Gary Gensler at the SEC is going to get booted out. And maybe, as a big maybe someone smarter is going to work it out and say, you know what, I'm going to change this to an ETF, okay? And your management fee goes to 15 basis points, okay? And so my discount to NAV.
To par,
boom, I go from 40% discount to par. Like, It might not happen. You know what, Hugh?
That's the first time I've heard it put that way. I haven't, you know, your comparison in terms of, you know, relative size in relation to the space that Bitcoin operates within, like it is considered, you know, the asset category, $100 trillion versus $500 billion market size is plausible. I mean, it suddenly makes the idea that Bitcoin could have a market cap of $2 trillion very plausible. So, but you're right. I mean, if you compare the relative sizes of other markets, the relativity isn't as quite as attractive. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I mean, can gold trade at 1,000? Sure, yeah, it can trade up to about 20. Like, yeah, but at 3,000, do you agree with the statement that
Bitcoin trades like the NASDAQ in terms of its charting? No, a lot of people have said that. I just, you know, that when NASDAQ recovered, so did Bitcoin. When NASDAQ tanked the last couple of, you know, over the last 2 years, so did Bitcoin. I mean, the correlation argument was gone, right? I mean, the correlation of Bitcoin to NASDAQ shot up. So did, you know, and then it's worked in reverse as well. As NASDAQ has recovered, so has Bitcoin to some extent. Yeah.
The retort to that is always that the incidence of rape, God forbid, gruesome, in New York is very, very tightly correlated to the consumption of ice cream.
All right. Is this just coincident causality? Yeah.
It's causality. Like in the height of this war, you know, with humidity and the temperature, you know, the mercury through the, you know, the dial, people go crazy.
So is it just a matter of risk like, on versus risk off? Or risk off versus risk on? No.
No, it's none of that. Yeah. There are more people talking than there's any wisdom in, you know, in the planet, you know, and it's a bit like the, I call it the my quantum theory of insanity, that I actually believe there's a fixed, an absolute fixed quantity of brain neurons in the universe. And so just as someone is actually getting it, right, because it's fixed, someone's got to lose it and stay in a kind of stasis. And, you know, that's Malkus for you. Let's lend it some credibility. What it's actually saying is that as an investor, this is appropriate for today. You want to be looking for the mania asset. You want to be looking for the bubble. You don't want to be running away from it. You most certainly don't want to be calling it names, yeah, right? Oh, this is overvalued. This is crazy. None of that. None of that. Okay. Especially if you're starting a fund, you got to find something which is going up and going up with a heck of a lot of energy. And for sure, that energy means there's probably annualizing right, a vol of between 35 and 50, right? All right. And you try and trade it. You try and trade it. And it's not impossible. And you set yourself up. Most hedge funds fail in the first year, right? This is what I did in 2000. I didn't fail.
Yeah.
In 2003, right? Gold was the rocket ship. Gold was insane. And I had everything in it. And I got 50%. And I got 15 right, years of running a hedge fund. Okay. But at any stage, if someone dropped me a line of credit, I'm telling you today, I would have, yeah, bucket load of Bitcoin. Let me retrace that. I'd be prepared to buy a bucket load. I'd have 20%, but I'd want 100%. Yeah. And so I'm waiting for it to, I need trend and I'll hit the trend. Okay. I would be leveraged through insanity owning 30-year treasuries. I mean, I have the 2-10 spread.
Right.
If we started to trend, okay. And I would have, even today, I mean, the thing that is trending, yes, I'd probably have 50% minimum in the video and the
you know,
the
microchips I remember, AI,
right?
I remember back in 2003, Sir John Templeton was featured in a Forbes article and he was worried that the pillars of the market were in trouble. You know, we had the Enron scandal. There was the Arthur Andersen scandal. There was a whole bunch of things happening, right, that were undermining the, yeah, you know, faith in the market. And in the article, he just basically says that, you know, for the first time in my entire life and career, and he was already gone from Franklin Templeton at the time, but he said in the article to Forbes that for the first time in his life, he was exiting equities and he was backing up the truck to long Canadian zeros and long US zeros, right? And I took it to heart. I took it to heart because I was already, you know, I was already feeling disillusioned that, you know, the ongoing conversations with clients about what was going on in the market, what's wrong with the market, why is this happening, how can that happen? And there's a lot of echo in what we talked about today with 2002, 2003, where, you know, a lot of things were happening, a lot of, you know, events were occurring that were undermining the faith in the market, in the system. And look, I mean, maybe he was premature in 2003, but obviously we know what happened, you know, 4 years, 5 years later, with the, you know, the coming apart of the financial system. But do you see any parallel there with 2003 and today? You were in the thick of it then, so the sentiment that Templeton felt at that moment when he would say something so publicly that was so conflicted with what he had said his entire career running, you know, gigantic Templeton funds.
Yeah. All I hear is the persistency of valid reasons to be skeptical or to be nervous or to believe that equities are going to collapse. It's remarkable that, you know, the great like stock guys end up sounding a little bit Marxian in that they think we've hit a permanent. He was effectively he was saying we've hit a permanent plateau,
and in that respect, he was wrong. But
push farther beyond that.
But he was maybe it was more near term defensive than long term. Right?
Again, takeaway for me would be as long as. Thank God he made one buy recommendation, right? You know, the zeros, and we know the zeros would be a great trade. But world changed, right? 25 years ago, 1998, the closure of the capital account meant, right, that every asset has been bid up. Like, he could have said any asset class in 2002. So I really wouldn't be here, but I'd be here, right? And he'd be wrong about this one, but and he'd be right. Everything's gone. It's been the boom market and everything.
I mean, it was really, you know, 2003 was following, you know, this massive rout in you know, the dot com era, right? Spokes of the wheel are do they, you know, do you see the parallel? I mean, it's not exactly the same, but, you know, like there's some questions now, for example, like, you know, on the audit side, like with the Arthur Andersen scandal, you know, back in 2003, and now today you've got KPMG, you know, signing off on Silicon Valley Bank's liquidity 2 weeks before they melted down. Right. So you have similar, you know, constraints, but I think it actually might tie back to what you were saying, which was that, you know, there's a real conflict of agendas. There's a real conflict of interest between, you know, what, you know, your point between, you know, putting in some measures to, you know, or barriers to capital from offshore and Wall Street. Right. I mean, and then if you go back and you look back at, you know, 2003, you have the same kinds of conflict of interest, you know, foxes guarding the hen house, whatever you want to call it. It's the same. It's very similar.
Right. It's capitalism. Okay. Right. So, I've got to watch my, what I said to you was, right. I said to you, I'm not a perpetual.
Neither am I. I'm not either.
I'm saying to you, you aren't. But I'm saying to you that, you know, for all of my enthusiasm for the treasuries and the vision of a global synchronized recession, I was saying to you, my goal is to rent treasuries. I think they're going to go up from 100 to 140 on the ETF. I think the stock market is going to fall. And boy, if it falls 30, 35%, I'm going to buy it, right? So the history of observations from really smart investors, right, is they're always worried, right? They're always worried. But in the course of the last 40 years, mercantilism has kept buying not goods and services manufactured in plants. They bought financial assets and they push them higher, right? So financial assets are going to be higher because the goons in Washington haven't figured it out. And until such time as the ordinary folk have a revolution, right, then asset prices are going to be higher and the poor folk are going to get poorer, right? So I, like I said, and I said to the folk, don't get angry with things. Don't exclude one to the other. Have modest allocations, big allocations. You be flexible of mind and look to reallocate. But when you see a big global asset fall 50%, you got to be a buyer. If you ain't a buyer,
exactly. We won't be it's what you do. It's not what you worry about.
You'll be irrelevant.
It's what you do. Last time we talked, Hugh, and then we'll close because I know you got to run and I got to run too. In our last appearance together, you talked about the glitch at Boeing, and I just wanted to bring that up because Boeing was around 130, 140 at the time, and today it's 211. So that was a really nice call. That was a really nice example call. Oh, wow. I'm not saying it's, you know, it wasn't advice. It was just, you know, in lieu of what you're saying right now, it's a similar kind of situation. I mean, so that gives, give or take 5%, that's a 30 or 40% return from the last time we spoke on that Boeing, right? And that was when they were having the whole 737 MAX issue was blowing up for the company and the stock was down. But given that, you know, we talked a little bit over a year ago, that's a pretty nice return given that last year was a rout. And but it's the glitch that matters, right? And like you're saying now, like look at the big global assets that are down 50%. That's the opportunity. The value traps. No.
Again, let me reply.
Yeah.
I'm saying if the S&P is down 50%, specific names, right? There's, like I said, I got luck. I haven't looked at Boeing. I was like, oh my God, is Boeing, like, is it fallen? I didn't know, right? But what I was saying with Boeing is...
But the market overreacted.
I can't say it's one of a kind. There's Boeing and oh, but no, but there's Boeing and Airbus. Okay. They had a profound, woeful glitch, right, which led to the deaths of, you know, too many unfortunate passengers, right? But there's not another Boeing. China won't have a Boeing. And artificial intelligence will not change. You won't be teleported. Okay. And the world will be financially richer and people will want to travel faster. Okay. And so there's a big moat around that business. There was a particularly heinous issue regarding it, and it presented itself as an opportunity. The long-term chart actually looks fascinating. I would say that I wouldn't wish to do anything at the present time with Boeing. For me, I'd want Boeing to trade through.
Right.
I'd just want to confirm to trade above 300. Just, I mean, I can, you throw me any chart and I will give you a long spiel. But just now it's done well, and it may oscillate a little bit. It'll really
You're the chart whisperer.
Something very powerful if it trades through 300.
You're the chart whisperer. You know. Well, listen, what's on your hot plate right now? Like, what do you think? We've talked about China. We've talked about long bonds. We've talked about Bitcoin. We've talked about cash. What do you think is the one of the most, or is it long bonds? What do you think is the most glaring? Is it the long bonds that you think is the most glaring opportunity? Is that the answer to the question? What do you think is the most glaring?
That is the answer. But until we get the establishment of price positive trend, it's still an intellectual speculation. A trade I have, God, I'm trying to remember the specifics of it, but I got an option spread in Apple. And I've got absolutely no axe to bear on Apple. But because it's deemed to be riskless, the options are, if you will, cheap. And I was proposing, again, an option with a 2025 expiry. I was proposing an option that's less than 10% out of the money. And I was suggesting that it would actually represent a legitimate hedge on that 1 in 20 risk that there is a military conflict between the United States and China. Apple has all of its has all of its smartphones made there. It's going to change that in 10 years' time. It will be radically different, but not today. And there's an option package where, you ask other people what's the probability and see if they're five, they might be higher. 1 in 20 is enormous. And I have yet to see a market talk person investor tell me what the trade is. I've just given you the trade. Check on my Twitter, you'll see the details to the. I must remind myself, but I think the app was about 170 or so, and I'm in the 140. But it's just it's cheap. So
where can people find you?
Can find me in St. Barts. They can find me. They can find me on Twitter, Hendry_View. They can find my podcast.
I love
the
that
Asset
hat.
Capitalist.
Yeah.
Where's my hat? The Asset Capitalist. You can find the Asset Cap. You can find that on YouTube, Spotify, the Apple Podcast, and you can find me
right.
And if you're looking for me on YouTube, Hugh Hendry Official. Likewise on Instagram.
And do you want to talk about the conference that you're having, or is that too premature?
By the time this goes out, it'll be pinned to my Twitter handle. So I encourage you to look. It's going to be fun. It's going to be many things. Maybe it'll be insightful. It's the end of August, August 21, and it might be just a chance to rinse, to get down, and just kind of conceive of some of the things which may be contentious today, but which
right.
may be forming more of an accepted belief system by the end of the year.
Hugh, once again, thank you so much for your friendship and your incredibly valuable time and your thoughts. It's just, it's amazing to catch up with you. I hope we can do this again soon.
Indeed. Always engaging. So thank you.